So for those of you who don't, most of you do know, but for those of you who don't, this is my old mate, Sangadeva. So Sangadeva, he helped set up this group back in the early 2000s. He'd come up from Birmingham, where he was living at the time, with a minibus full of cushions, or a van full of cushions, and he'd lead classes in the old Quaker meeting house. And he did that for a number of years, and he's been a good friend to this centre. He's now living at Adishtana, which I refer to as Sri Ratna HQ, which is down near Ledbury, where Sangharaksha is living, and there's a men's community, a women's community, and lots of other things going on as well. It's a really exciting place. Mm. You might talk about a little bit about that. Mm. And this is the third time he's come up, and we've sort of done this where I kind of interview him, which he really likes. We have a little bit of a chat. I find out what's kind of making him tick or what's inspiring him, and then I can see if I can kind of tune into that, and then I just kind of have to let him go then, really. It's like the Duracell bunny once he gets going. So what I thought, I've got a few questions to get him going, and then I just thought, if on a particular theme, if there's anyone, rather than sort of having a period at the end, maybe if there's anything that sparks anyone off to ask, then just feel free to maybe say something, put your hand up or something. So our sort of vague topic, or our specific topic, depending which way you look at it, is spiritual friendship. Mm. So we've looked at, in the past, last time we talked a little bit about Adishtana. Mm. We talked a little about how excited he was and how things were developing at Adishtana. We talked about the importance of insight in one's spiritual practice. And then we talked a little bit about the role Sri Ratna can play in today's seemingly unstable and unpredictable world. And we might return to that last bit, because I think that was, we just started to kind of look at that last time. But I'm going to kick us off with a very classic question about spiritual friendship, which is the Buddha's conversation with Ananda, his cousin and dear friend and companion throughout his life, or the latter part of his life. And he said, the Buddha said to Ananda that spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. So I just wonder if you could share your views on that, how important you feel spiritual friendship is in the spiritual life, and your personal take on it and your sort of experience of that. And also maybe clarifying what we mean by spiritual friendship, or Kalyana Mitrata, as it's commonly referred to.
The first Buddhist I met was in 1980. It was Padmaraja. Some of you may have heard of Padmaraja, the infamous Padmaraja. He's no longer in our order, unfortunately, in some ways, in many ways. And I knocked on the door of Ariyatara, which is the oldest community in our movement. It was founded in 1967. It was then the centre in Purley, where the Buddhist centre was at those days. And I'd missed the meditation, so I'd come after the meditation started, so he just took me into the front room, and he just listened to my story. And I had this really strange experience that for the first time in my life someone was actually listening to me. It might sound like a strange thing to say. You know how we all do it when someone's talking? You're so often thinking about what associations that has for you, or what you're going to say, or whatever it is. And that's sort of communicated to the other person. Whether they know it or not, they sort of know that on some level that you're not really listening to them. But I had this uncanny experience that for the first time in my life, someone wasn't doing that. That someone was just taking me in. It's a very exceptional experience, and it really affected me very deeply. I think particularly because I was going through, well, I suppose I'd just come out of a bit of a breakdown. But I felt a being listened to seemed to be a profoundly significant experience. And to me, that's what I think my experience of being in Sri Ratna community is, that all of us develop those skills. I think we're pretty good at that. I think that's one of the things that we're very, very good at in Sri Ratna. I think we're very, very good at communicating. Generally speaking, I think our communication skills are extremely good. And I think to me that's the essence of the spiritual life, is sort of deep listening, if you like, deep communication between people who share deeply held values. I don't see how the spiritual life cannot have that as its almost central sort of central idea, if you like. Communication is at the centre of everything. If there wasn't communication, there'd be no spiritual life. We're all here because someone has taken an interest in us. So for me, communication and therefore friendship, which comes out of deep communication, to me is the centre of the spiritual life. I think without it, we don't have anything to join in with. We don't have anything to express our values in relation to. So that was my experience, a deep listening.
Okay. So moving on from that, I remember when we were talking Adishtana over a cuppa.
Yeah.
You talked about the dynamics of human communication.
Yeah.
And you talked a little bit about the mysterious.
Yeah.
The fact it alters your state of consciousness.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you'd, and we also got onto the subject of Eros.
Oh yeah.
And fear around Eros.
Okay.
So that'll get you going, won't it?
Yeah.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about that dynamics of human communication in relationship to spiritual friendship.
Yeah. Well, there's communication and communication, isn't there? There's sort of like talking, there's exchanging ideas, there's asking people how they are about their family. And I mean really asking, I don't mean just out of politeness, you know, when you're genuinely interested. But there's another level of communication that is quite risky. I don't know how many of you have done communication exercises. Have you done communication exercises?
Yeah, we did them on the recent Sangha retreat.
I think it's really good. I think communication exercises are a real eye-opener. Mm-hmm. You realise how when you're sitting opposite that person, you're just looking at them. You know, you can feel everything in your sort of psyche sort of doing this. And, you know, so, well, why am I doing that? What's going on? It's like on a deep level, we've built up all these sort of ways of not actually really being open with other people. Actually, I think we're not ways of not being open with ourselves. So communication is profoundly challenging. And when I would say, well, that's interesting. Why is it so challenging? I think that's a great quote. That's a really interesting question that we should ponder. And I think it can only be that it's challenging because we might change. Something might change. And what we experience when we communicate is we hold on to self. That's the very thing that we fear. We fear losing who we are. I mean, that's evolution. That's evolutionary. That's how we've got here. We've needed to develop an ego. We've needed to develop a sense of self and self-preservation. But when we meet other people, when we come into contact with other people, I think it's inevitable that starts getting challenged because our reality is not necessarily the reality of the other person. So clearly there's some gap between the two realities. And I think the challenge is in communication is to let go into the reality of other, as it were. And the thing is that when you do that, it's like Pandora's box. You open the lid, you don't know what you're going to let out. And I think that we all know that that's what's going to happen. And I think we should be not naive about that. You don't know what can come out. I realised that actually a lot of what came out was incredibly positive. I think a lot of what we don't let out is actually the really, really positive side of our being. But there's also other things that come out as well. You don't know. And sometimes things come out that you'd rather not didn't come out. So the element of of Eros, the element of attraction, the element of something, as it were, coming like Eros almost like comes. I don't mean Eros in the grossly sexual sense. I just mean that sort of sense that you meet another being, you meet another person, and something else comes into existence as you communicate. Something slightly other, and that can be quite scary. And I've had very strong experiences of this in my own life. And you know, you have these experiences, and then you can get incredibly inspired. I had a conversation with Vajragupta one night at Adishtana, and Vajragupta is someone with whom, when I'm in deep communication with him, time stands still. It's a very, very strange experience. If you have this when you're in deep communication with somebody, time stands still, and something else comes into being. And I think there are certain people that you do experience that other quality, that sort of otherness that comes in. It's not sexual, but it's definitely to do with eros, it's to do with love, it's to do with beauty, it's to do with other. And I think that when you're really communicating with another person, and somebody who you're deeply in tune with, I think these elements definitely come in. I don't think you can avoid it. But it can be a little bit scary sometimes to just let go into that and really, really communicate and really, really be open to another person.
Okay.
Do you ever get the, you know, when you're going about deep communication?
Yes.
And you're saying you feel that love.
Yes.
Is there ever the opposite of that, that you both of you open up and actually there's conflict? Or you both open up and you're not on the same... Is that part of why it's scary to open up?
I mean, I've not found that myself, because I usually test the water first, you know, and I sort of, you know, you do, don't you? You sort of test the water first. I think that the first thing is the element of the shared values. I think that that's probably only really, that sort of level of communication is probably more likely to happen between people who have very, very deeply shared values. So you can always go towards the values that you share. The values link you much more deeply than your likes and dislikes, or even your disagreements, even very strong disagreements about other things, maybe more worldly things. And the thing is always to come back to your deep shared values. And that's the beauty of True Ratna community and True Ratna order, is that whether we know it or not, we deeply share values together. We probably don't talk about that enough, actually, but I think actually on a very, very deep level we share values on a level deeper than we probably realise, actually. Far deeper than we realise. I think that's what cements this movement together. So I think that's how I experience it. I mean, sometimes it can get a bit fractious, can't it? But then you go, come on, more. There's something much higher that links us together here. Let's go back to that.
Okay. So Kalyana Mitrata, this idea, yes. Kalyana, which is a kind of Buddhist concept, really,
yes.
Meaning spiritual friendship.
Yes.
So you can translate it as sort of noble friendship, or yeah. Beautiful friendship, or admirable friend.
Yeah.
So these relationships or friendships can have a vertical element,
yes.
And they can have a horizontal element,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which we talk about sometimes in True Ratna.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
I just wanted to hear your take on that and your reflections on the on that experience of the vertical and the horizontal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's really interesting. I'm just reading a very interesting book at the moment by, I don't know how many of you have heard of Robert Bly. He's an American poet and social commentator. It's called The Sibling Society. And it's a sort of devastating critique of the modern world, and the fact that, for all sorts of reasons that he argues, is that we live in a world of half adults, where none of us have really grown up. It's quite a challenging concept, really. And he thinks that one of the problems with modern society is that the vertical dimension is virtually absent. You know, that nobody's better than anyone else. Hierarchies are sort of all brought down to we're all equal, we're all the same. No value, nobody's values are better than anybody else's values. And we get into sort of a sort of whole level of sort of mediocrity, and it's quite a devastating critique, actually. But he mentions the fact that I've just bought this quote that he quotes Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell's a, I don't know, what is he? He's a writer, but I don't know how you describe him. He's done a lot of writing on the myth of the hero. He's done the hero with a thousand faces and things like that. So again, he's very much in the camp of James Hillman and Robert Bly and these sort of what you call these archetypal psychologists. And he said something really, really interesting. And he said, in order to receive a new world of meaning involves the body-soul. We can just put that to one side. Body-soul, what does that mean? What's a poetic term? The body-soul being changed in order to receive what Joseph Campbell calls the inexhaustible energies of the cosmos that pour down towards human beings. It's lovely. This idea that the cosmos is pouring down this inexhaustible energies. And then he goes on to say, without gratitude towards energies much greater than our own, there will be no new meanings. It could be said that we lack the imagination now to imagine any new power to whom we could be grateful. The procedure for young men and women, because he's talking about young women in this, I would say middle-aged women and men as well, would ask a reintroduction to the dangerous energies of nature. This process is messy and needs teachers, the out of doors and lots of time. So this is, in a way, the central thesis that Robert Bly has. You know, he's sort of quoting to Joseph Campbell, that there are these inexhaustible energies pouring down towards us from the universe. I love this idea. The higher element is pouring down towards us all the time. But in the modern world, for whatever reason, we're distracted. We don't believe in that anymore. It's to do with, we think it's something to do with God or some authority or something like that. But Campbell purposely uses the term energies. It's a very, very sort of very general term. And he says this thing, without gratitude towards energies much greater than our own, there will be no new meanings. And I think for me that's absolutely the crux of it. It's the whole element of gratitude. It's gratitude to something that is beyond us and that is greater than us. There's a lovely poem by Rilke, and it says that, mankind's victories make them small. In order to be truly great, a man should be defeated decisively by constantly greater beings. So he says that the real victory, if you want to be really great, you should allow yourself to be defeated by constantly greater beings. So this theme comes out in poetry and literature a lot, this idea that there is a force greater than us pouring towards us from the universe, and that we need to open ourselves to this energy. And that is so against the modern thinking. You know, that can be nothing higher than us, nothing greater than us. Nothing can make us change. Nothing can tell us anything. Okay, we might not articulate that consciously. We might not say that. But probably emotionally, I suspect, we do feel that. On some level, I suspect, there is that sort of feeling. So for me, Kalyana Michtar has these two dimensions. It has the ordinary friendship level of just meeting like-minded people who are more or less on the same level as oneself and making friends and being open to them. But I think it also has to entail some sense of gratitude towards something greater than ourselves. Otherwise, what are we changing into? You know, if we're not changing into something greater, or we can't imagine something greater, then why are we bothering? You see what I'm saying? So, the game's up. I think we have to reflect. I think we should reflect on this. That there is something greater than us, and that gratitude is what helps us perceive what is greater than us. And that's why I think our practices that we do here, you've done in the centre, I know, of rejoicing in merits is a fantastic practice. Just on the ordinary horizontal level, let alone to those that we consider to be greater than us. But I think the practice of rejoicing in merits and focusing on the positive. I mean, this world, we all know, don't we? With so much negativity in the world. Like, I read an article today about Rory McIlroy. Did anyone read that in the paper? Or in the, you know, just because he did a round of golf with Donald Trump, he's being accused of a fascist and a bigot. And he said something like, it was only a round of golf, excuse me. You know, social media is pouring in at us, giving us all this comment. Anyone can comment on anyone else's life. And we're in this, and I'm not saying that that isn't necessary, which is not always bad. But what I'm saying is that we tend to be so dominated by this will to pull everything down to the same level. And it is, whether we know it or not, it's really enervating. It really drains energy. And it's constantly prevents us from looking up towards things that are greater than us, towards gratitude. So that's my take on Kalyanamitta, that's got that other dimension, the higher dimension, that really is absolutely key. And if you don't have that, I don't think you have a spiritual, effective spiritual life.
Okay, so what does that mean for you? How does that take shape in your life?
Well, I suppose it means, A, this might sound like a strange, an ordinary thing to say, A, I'm not special. So I don't mean that just like as in my head, I'm going, well, I'm not special. It means like deep, it means feeling deeply on a certain level that you're not special. That sounds like a strange thing to say, doesn't it? But for me, it's really important. Like tonight, I was struggling with this whole issue of being special. I was sitting there and meditating, and I had to remind myself, I'm not special. And I think that whether, again, this is something that I realised about 20 years ago, one day this little voice said to me, you're not special. And it was like, I was like a kid. You know when kids, children, you tell a child off and they put their fingers in the air and go, la, 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 I can't hear you. La, la. And I remember this voice telling me I wasn't special. And it really was like a body blow. It was like... Pfft. So I think that not being special is a really, really important thing to reflect on, that you're not special. And that if you're not special, then I think then you can be open to these greater energies pouring towards you in the universe. So it's just like quite paradoxical. I think life is full of these sort of conundrums. To the extent that you don't see yourself as special, you can have this experience of something coming towards you from let's say the cosmos. And so for me, when I meditate, I basically try to see myself in the right place in relation to the ideal. So it's have a real experience of oneself just being open. So sitting there, literally, sometimes, there's this phrase in one of the pujas we do which says, take possession of me, O sublime beings. It's in one of our pujas. Except I go, take possession of us, O sublime beings. So that's what I do. I just sit there and I just say, take possession of us, O sublime beings. Sounds quite strange, doesn't it? But it's what works for me. I think that for me, being open to these higher energies is my main practice. And I don't, a lot of order members do sadhana practices. So they take on some figure like the Buddha or Avalokiteshvara and that. But I don't do that. I just have a blank canvas. My sadhana is a white canvas, maybe with a big question mark in it. I'm not filling it in yet. I don't want to fill it in. I just want to keep it as an open space and sit there with that sort of almost unbearable pain of absence, the absence of the ideal, if you like. You know what I mean? So it's like having faith that the ideal is, there is something moving towards me, but not rushing towards it to sort of embrace it. Almost to let it embrace me when it's ready to embrace me. So something like that. So a quite formless way of approaching it.
And that's very much in your meditation practice.
That's very much
in, because there's also practice. I know you see very much your work as part of your practice. I mean, your whole lifestyle, really.
Well, just helping out. I mean, for me, helping out. I mean, I've always... It's a pity that in the Mitra thing we have these three... statements. What are they called? Those of you who do Mitra Seminary, three statements or three declarations. That's it. They're called three declarations. We used to have four declarations. For some reason, we don't have the declaration willing to help out at your local centre. For some reason, we don't have that. I think it's just assumed that you will anyway. But I'd like to reintroduce that one. You know, when you become a Mitra, you say, A, I'm a Buddhist. B, I'm practicing the precepts or trying to practice precepts. C, I'm doing it in the context of Tree Rattling Community. And let's have a D, willing to help out at your local centre. And I think for the reason for that is that actually, I think if you really do feel you're a committed Buddhist, which is what you're saying when you're a Mitra, that will actually be enacted. You'll actually be knocking on the door saying, can I clean the toilets, or can I help out the class, or can I be on a team, or can I start an outreach group, please? Anyway, it's one of my little things, don't worry about it. Can I help? You know, and I think to me that's saying, like, yeah, I want to help. So I suppose, you know, in whatever way I can, you know, the way I help is in practical ways. I'm not one of these people that gives lots of talks or do study or stuff like that, but I've always been able to be helpful. So cooking, gardening, doing whatever's necessary. And I think one's commitment to the Three Jewels will have a practical implication, and it will mean that you'll just want to give. You'll just want to give your time and energy. So for me, that's the other way I do it. So, you know, there's those two ways. And they're sort of quite simple, really.
I can very much relate to the service, the work.
Yeah. Sandra.
When you say nothing special.
Yeah.
And that whole thing around that. Would you say that was true humility?
Oh, I don't know what true humility is. I mean, where do you get to true humility? It's like, how long is a piece of string? I mean, I don't really know. It's just you cultivate it as an idea, don't you? I mean, it's like you always catch yourself, you know, metaphorically speaking, you know, doing that, don't you? You know what I mean? You know, you sort of one of those unguarded moments where you sort of realise you're doing a little pose. You know, you go, whoops. Oh, I think I'm special, don't I? Yes, you do. So you've just got to go back and sort of go, okay, that was embarrassing, wasn't it? Do you know what I mean? So you constantly catch yourself out. You can never be humility. That humility is way off of most of us. But so you just try and do better every time, and you constantly observe where you're just going, me, 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 me. You know, and it's a difficult thing to do because it's just so much part of our evolutionary, that's how we got here. It's part of our evolutionary process. And undoing that is a very long and difficult, as Bly says, it's a very long and difficult process. And dangerous process.
Is there another way of looking at it, in that everybody is special?
Yeah, you could say that, yeah. You could say that, yeah. I mean, in fact, in the Tibetan tradition, that's how you view everybody else. You view yourself as being the lowest. I mean, this is a quite high practice, by the way. I'm not saying this is easy to do. You view yourself as being lower than everybody else. And I don't mean that in a sense of pride, where you, oh, I'm very humble. But you actually, the idea is that you, as a practice, you see everybody is superior to you. And you see yourself as the lowest of the low. But one mustn't see that in it's not a psychological low as a low. It's a spiritual practice. It's not a psychological practice, if you see what I'm saying. It's difficult to make that distinction. You know, it's done for positive reasons, not because you want to flagellate yourself or punish yourself. So you see everyone as a teacher, or your teacher, for instance, that everybody's going to teach you something. You're not going to look at their faults. You won't necessarily not be aware of their faults, but you won't focus on their faults. You'll focus on their positive qualities. You'll always focus on their positive qualities. So it's
that feels easier to respond to a sense of kind of receptivity to others, appreciation of them. I definitely felt kind of alarm bells at the idea of I'm not, you know, of encouraging people to think I'm not special, because of what that could feed into psychologically in terms of kind of low self-esteem and
I agree with you.
Down, so I just thought, ooh,
I agree with
let's
you.
Let's be careful with that.
Well, that's when we study the eight verses, you know, and there's a, you know, the short version of the Bodhicaryavatara. That's why you would not do that with people that weren't definitely committed to the spiritual life, because it can be so easily taken in the wrong way. I'm only saying it because it's something I've reflected on, and I think you're right. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it as a practice, but it is there in the canon, as it were, in the Buddhist canon. So it is a recommended practice, but you can't immediately take that up.
Okay. Oh, Alan?
Could you say something about, you said it's a dangerous thing as well.
Beg your pardon?
You said it's a dangerous thing as well. Could you say something a bit more about that?
What is it?
Friendship.
All this stuff you're talking about.
Yeah, it is. Well, it is.
It is the communication.
It is dangerous. I mean, it is dangerous. I mean, the thing is, you know, sometimes we have this very romantic view of the spiritual life, you know, what it's going to be like, and, you know, it's like this, it's like that, and you get on, and then suddenly things start emerging which you just don't like the sound of, either in yourself or in other people.
Yeah.
And I think I've had a huge crash in the middle of my spiritual life after I was ordained for 14 years, you know, and I had this experience where, again, I had this another sort of, I suppose it was a sort of semi-visionary experience where I was doing some sort of shamanic-y type journey on a convention in the mid-90s. And this voice, I keep hearing voices, don't I? Don't get me wrong, I'm not schizophrenic, but I do hear voices sometimes. This tree said to me, "You've gone for refuge to the," it used to be called the Western Buddhist Order, "You've gone for refuge to the Western Buddhist Order. Sorry, you've gone for refuge to the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. You've gone for refuge to the Western Buddhist Order. You've gone for refuge to Buddhism. Now you must go for refuge to and within yourself." And I just wept. I sort of burst into tears. I was like just like devastated because it started off by saying, "You've come home." And I said, "Well, I've already come home to Buddhism." And now it said, "You're coming home to yourself." So I think the danger is always there that you lose yourself in the form. You lose yourself in the group. You lose yourself in the teacher or the teachings or the Buddhism or this or that or whatever it is, that you start thinking that you are that, but you're not that. You're something profoundly more mysterious. But what that does is it throws you back on your own individuality. And of course we don't want to be individual. We want to latch onto a group, or we want to latch onto a teacher, or we want to latch onto an ism. We don't know we're doing it because we come along. Of course, we think we're individuals, you know. But actually, what you slowly start discovering is that you're not actually as individual as you like to think you were. It's inevitable if you're practicing seriously that those will just get kicked away from under you. At some stage, you're going to be on the floor. You know, you can't help it, because as human beings, we identify ourselves by the things that we get involved with. So that's people, ideas, culture, colour of our skin, sexual orientation, whatever it is. Ultimately, those are all going to get kicked away. You cannot avoid that. Now, some people, they go through a spiritual life where they don't seem to struggle with those sorts of things. But some of us, and I have very much struggled with this myself, I have ended up on my arse quite a few times. And it's been incredibly bewildering. And it's taken me a long time to work out what's gone on. But I've only got myself to talk to. You know what I mean? I mean, I can talk to about other people, but you can only work it out on your own. You are on your own. You're with other people, but you're on your own. You are going to have to work these things out on your own. So it can sometimes be a bit lonely and a bit frightening. You can suddenly think, "Oh my God, this is all a sham." And you could suddenly think, "What on earth am I doing? This is..." You know what I mean? Well, I've seen it happen to many people.
I have that on a recent retreat.
Well, there you go. You see what I'm saying? So suddenly this, like, the carpet is constantly being pulled. And it has to be. That's the project that the Dharma is confronting us with. You know, if it isn't doing that... And the Sangha, we've been playing around with a few quotes from Sangha Rakshita recently. Once in one seminar... He said, "Now this is a sort of almost Nietzschean in its extremity." He said, "If you don't feel you're hanging upside down by one leg over a precipice, it's not the Dharma." Okay, so that's Nietzsche. That's sort of Nietzschean sort of aphorism. So you will feel that, and you will want to blame other people for that or other things. And I've done a lot of that. I've got all sorts of stories, horror stories I could tell you about the people I've been blaming in my spiritual life. But ultimately, you have to withdraw your blame, and you have to realise, look, at the end of the day, I am responsible for my actions. I cannot be responsible for anybody else's actions. So it you have to have a strong basis of faith and confidence and good friendships if you're going to enter in the spiritual life, because you will at some stage encounter those sorts of things. Some people don't encounter them so much, some encounter them more. I think it depends on your character, but there will always be difficulties, I think.
Well, I'd just like to say that whilst you are on your own, you can't practice, people can't practice the Dharma for you.
No.
But they can certainly practice with you.
They certainly can.
So that's, the for me, the importance of spiritual friendship. Definitely. To have those strong bonds, that strong network.
Yeah. I mean, when I fell to pieces in the 90s, you know, I went to an audit convention, and a lot of people who knew me, they could see I needed space, and no one came up to me and bounded up to me saying, "How are you, Sangadeva?" People just instinctively left me alone. So it's funny, you know, spiritual friendship can be that people are just sensitive to where you are and they give you space. That's another dimension. That's a real art in spiritual friendship, is that you know when to communicate and when to leave people alone. And sometimes people need space. So it works in all sorts of different ways.
Okay. Just a slightly changed tack.
Go on.
So Triratna's 50 this year.
Yes.
We were hearing about that earlier. And you've been part of it for most of your adult life.
Yes.
You've watched it change, grow, develop, grow up.
Yeah, grow up, yeah.
Yeah. And you've seen it through some ups and downs,
yeah.
Some of which we're talking and reflecting on at the moment. So I just wondered how you see it going forward. I mean, how you... So what's your kind of vision, if you like, for the movement in today's world?
Well,
just a little question.
Yes. Well, like, you know, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? You know, they say there's nothing like an old revolutionary. I sort of feel that in many ways, I feel as revolutionary as I did when I was 23, when I walked into the door of a centre. I feel more fired up, more excited. And I feel more excited because now I know I can trust my excitement. It's a bit more mature than it was when I was 23. So it's based on experience. So the fact that I'm excited means, oh, that's pretty good, because that means I can trust that. I feel incredibly optimistic and excited about the future of the Dharma in the modern world. And I particularly feel excited about this particular grouping of people. Because I do feel, and I always have felt, that there is something deeply inspiring and relevant about the Dharma as manifested in the Triratna community. There's something to me, there's an atmosphere in this particular grouping of people. I'm sure it exists in other groupings of people, but in this grouping of people, I feel really confident that there is something emerging. There's something emerging amongst us. And I also feel that there's something emerging in the world at the moment. You know, it's very easy to be negative about current world events and be very, very dour about them. But when you look at some of the greatest arisings of great individuals, they came about at times of tremendous turmoil, social turmoil. Anything like Socrates and people like that. I mean, Socrates was in the army. He may even have killed people. We don't really know. His life was constantly under threat. And he emerged from a time of tremendous social turmoil. I don't think that social turmoil is always a bad thing. Of course, the rule of law is very important, and that's incredibly valuable. If that breaks down, then we are in big trouble. But I think that we are living in very, very exciting times. And I feel in many ways that... I'm sort of reminded of the 80s, actually, when I got involved in the movement. There are lots of young people emerging into the movement now. We had 55 young, what do they call them, young persons facilitators down at Adhisthana. And these are the people who are just facilitating young people in the movement. More and more young people now are turning towards the Dharma, turning towards Buddhism. I think they feel profoundly let down. You know, I mean, they're paying for us, by the way. You know, like all the money that our generations and the other generations have borrowed, they're the ones who are going to pay it back, as it were. And I think they're not stupid, they know. And I think they feel that there needs to be something more. And I think they are looking towards the future, as we are. It's not just the young. I mean, here we are. That's what we're looking towards, the future. So I do feel that actually we are living in very, very interesting times, which I know in China is a bit of an insult, but we are living in interesting times, and I think the opportunities for the Dharma in the world are immense. And I feel really excited about the opportunities that could emerge for us in the future. I think the times are tide is changing, and I think people are looking for something alternative. I think people are sort of getting fed up with the modern world in many ways. So I think the future is very, very exciting and very bright. And it depends on how seriously we all practice. You know, it's down to us to work on our minds. You know, it's not down to anyone else. It's down to each of you, each of us individually, to really work on our minds, to really develop positive states of mind.
So you talked a little bit there about the early 80s and the excitement around the early 80s. And it's interesting, there's a bit of reflection around the sort of naivety of those times, as well as that kind of excitement. So there seems to be more of an emphasis on the sort of negativity rather than the positivity at the moment. So I was just thinking whether there was a positive take from those days that we can take for now. Or do you think the excitement you feel emerging has a sort of level of maturity as well? So do you think there's a similar level of excitement, but it's just got that maturity of a number of years of practice?
I mean, I think the problem with looking back to how things were in the early days, even with Bantu and his sexuality and all the rest of it, is, you know, you think it was a movement like it was now. It wasn't. We were all in our 20s. Bantu was in his 40s. It was an experiment. There weren't many of us. You know, I mean, some of the order conventions in the 70s, this would be the total number of order members sitting in a room at Ariatara in Purley, you know, in this little residential house. That was the order, with Bantu sitting there and a few people. And, you know, Bantu, when he started the movement, he had no clue he didn't have some sort of blueprint worked out. In fact, mostly, he didn't work it out. He just set the principles in motion, and a lot of other people did the working out, the details of it. You didn't have a clue where it was going to go. It was like literally sitting in a room and pulling down these forces pouring down from the cosmos and going, well, how are we going to manifest these in the world? It wasn't that's as worked out as it was. You know, of course, Bantu had all the Dharma, all his Dharma knowledge, and he understood what ethics were. He understood what going for refuge were. But it was just a huge melting pot with bubbling, with bits of fat sort of spilling over the edge, and probably some people definitely got burned by it. Yes. You know. You know, and it was naive and very childish in a way. And when I was managing Hopley's Vegetarian Restaurant, which is one of the first Right Livers, at one time, I don't know if any of you saw that interview with Glenn. Glenn, the guy who did a little thing on... actually, I think it was partly his articles in The Observer. Well, he was in my team, and I was managing a team with five teenagers then. I mean, that's how young we were. So it's hardly surprising that there was a bit of shenanigans going on. You know what I mean? You know, blokes, I mean, when I was living at Ariatara, and, you know, some of the guys, I mean, they didn't realise that they could fancy blokes. They were jumping into bed with each other, just trying it out. Let's have a go. It was good fun. And in many ways, it was punk era. So a lot of our attitudes, a lot of people that came into the movement, they were sort of punks in a way. And I think we have to remember that it was a very, very different time in the 80s to what it is now, incredibly different. And we were very young, very naive, and we did some silly things, and we made some mistakes. But it was exciting. But I feel more confident now, because I think that we are mature, much more mature. I don't think we're going to make those mistakes again, but I do think that we still have got that excitement, and I still think we need to focus on that. In fact, in a meeting I was in with Bante in the preceptors meeting, where the men and women preceptors were with Bante, someone asked him a question: what, Bante, do you think is not present now that was existing in the early days of the movement? And he said, if I was to name one thing, I would say excitement. That's really interesting. So that was about 8 or 9 years ago. But I do feel now that there is excitement. I think excitement is starting to come back again. And certainly where I'm living down at Ajisthana is, it's just really exciting, isn't it, by and large? Because you're down there 2 days a week. So it's really exciting, and I think we can be excited.
So you mentioned Sangharakshita.
Yes.
And I know you've known him a long time.
Uh-huh.
I just wonder how you see him in terms of spiritual friendship with yourself.
Yeah.
And maybe something of the, we talked about this before, the kind of atmosphere
of
banter.
Yeah.
I wonder if you wanted to just share a little bit about your relationship to him in that sense.
I mean, it's obviously really sort of personal, isn't it? I suppose in a way it was a bit like falling in love in a way when I met Bhante. And what do I mean? I don't really know what I mean, actually. All I know was that I met this person, or I listened to this guy's lectures, and it was literally being completely taken out of myself. I can't describe the feeling. And I trust that because one of the things I've always trusted in my life is I've always trusted my responses to things. Which I think over the last 35 years has been borne out as being a good quality. I trusted my experience of Bhante. You know, we think of wizards and magicians and devas and gods and these special beings. What would it be like to meet one? Well, I've met one. I met Sangharakshita. I mean, I can't justify that to you. It's not rational. It's not irrational, but it's not a entirely irrational response. But I felt I was coming into contact. I mean, I did feel I was coming into contact with these energies coming from the cosmos. That's the only thing I can say. And I do not know how to justify that to anybody. I can't explain it to you. And I remember I started drawing pictures to Bhante. So I drew this picture, and this is slightly embarrassing, actually. But it's personal, but it does. I think it's important that I give you a flavour of what Bhante was to me. I drew a picture of a naked man with his arm around this shepherd boy. And the naked man was, completely muscular, and the naked boy had a cowl over his head. And I thought, God, I remember drawing this picture, and I was, how naive is that? But I sent it to Bhante. And, that's an incredibly... I mean, what are you doing that to an older man? Why are you doing that? I have no idea, do you know what I mean? But I just felt I had to, because I felt in some way it described what I felt Bhante was to me. He was like this naked... It wasn't beautiful in any sense in sort of physical terms, but psychically, spiritually, it was sort of divinely beautiful. And I was this sort of slightly sort of coward sort of young boy with a sort of hood over his face. And Bhante for me is a sort of, I think it's this revered psychopomp. He's a person that has come from, or comes from a different dimension and drew me out. He just drew something out of me. That's the only way I can describe it. Almost like, I wouldn't say against my will, but almost against my will. It wasn't that I decided, this wasn't a conscious thing that I worked out. It was like, literally like being taken out of myself. So I find it really, when I hear Bhante talked about in terms of like being a sexual predator or all the rest of it and stuff like that, I just think, oh my God. It's like, it wasn't like that. It was not like that. It was not like that at all. It was like meeting someone from a different dimension. I can't expect anyone, I'm not expecting anyone to have that experience. I'm not saying that anyone should have that or see him like that. But that's how I experienced it. And I wasn't the only one. Those of us that were sort of closer to him had this overwhelming experience of some greater power embodied in a human being. And it wasn't just hero worship. I mean, I absolutely know that. There's just no doubt in my mind that it wasn't just hero worship. It was something other. And I think it was spiritual beauty. It was definitely spiritual beauty that drew me to Bhante. I still don't really understand it. You know, and I personally did. You know, I did. I was involved with Bhante sexually, not very long, but we did engage in some sexual activity, which for me was fairly straightforward. at least at the time. Later it got a bit complicated because of the issues that we're dealing with now. But that's another story. I don't want to read back too much into that experience. So there was a sort of a ferment of something that is so difficult to communicate. A ferment of spiritual eroticism or something. I don't know. But that's my own take on it. I'm not saying other people, a lot of other people didn't experience it like that. But that's my own, because I suppose my character is I'm a sort of lover type, you know what I mean? I respond to eros and love and beauty and the erotic. But I know not everybody does. But to me, that's an essential part of the spiritual life. You cannot leave that out of, you cannot leave that side out of the spiritual life. That side of you has to come into the spiritual life. You know, it's the part of us that we, well, it's chaotic, isn't it? Like when you fall in love, you know, you don't know whether you're upside down or on the right way up. And, you know, you don't know whether to go towards the object or away from the object. Do you love it? Do you hate it? You don't really know. Sometimes you love it, sometimes you hate it. You know, they don't look at you, feel devastated. You know, all that, those, you know, all those sort of emotions, they don't go away just because we've got into 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s. They're all still there waiting to be drawn out. So that's the other thing I was going to say. That's the other element of the danger of the spiritual life, is the sort of that element of eros, of the erotic, of all that sort of chaotic energy that is still in all of us. That all needs to be drawn out and drawn into the spiritual life. It doesn't go away just because we get older. I'm glad I've said that in public, actually. I've said it to individuals, but it's important for me to say that in public because of particularly what's going on at the moment with, you know, the way people are reading Bhante's past. I read it in quite a different way, although I do share some of the objections to it in certain ways, but that's another story. I won't go into that now.
Okay.
Thanks for asking that question.
No. I'm just looking at time. We've gone over time, as usual.
Yeah.
So I'd just like to thank... I mean, it's always a thrill with Seth, because your openness and your honesty is great. There's a load more questions I could ask you, so maybe we'll have to do this again. But... thanks, Sangadeva, for coming up. He's not too far away. He's always very willing. He thinks of himself, and I think of him as a Kalyana Mitra to this Sangha, which is great. And he's always happy to come up and help out in any way, shape or form. So thanks for coming up, Sangadeva.
Yes, pleasure.
See you next time.
Good. Hope you find it helpful.